crema.
Welcome to the 8th episode of The Definitives, a limited-time music podcast detailing the makings and legacies of some of the greatest rock albums ever made. I'm your host, Blake Peterson, and today we'll be talking about Master of Puppets, the third studio album by the iconic heavy metal group Metallica. I'll never know what it was like to live in a time during which Metallica wasn't the most famous metal group in the world. Metal is hardly a ubiquitous mainstream genre, but the name Metallica and the sound of Metallica are things that even the least thrash-inclined might be quick to recognize. They, decades after forming, continue to be everywhere and are easy to access. 10 albums, 10 video albums, and 41 music videos are at my disposal. Countless live performances, many of which have been viewed tens of millions of times, have been uploaded to YouTube. I could stream 2004's Some Kind of Monster, a documentary that depicts the band's near breakup in the early aughts. I could rent 2013's Metallica Through the Never, a concert movie come action thriller that seems to exist for no other reason besides, why not? I could drive to the nearest Target and purchase a Metallica t-shirt. Perhaps one is folded between Nirvana-focused or Pink Floyd-centered raiment. I could travel to Amazon.com to purchase Guitar Hero Metallica for my PlayStation 2 for just $34.92, not including tax or shipping. Metallica, who was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2009, has come to a point where to call them royalty, an honorific I've come to detest in part due to its overusage, is most appropriate. They helped pioneer a genre and created some of the most ambitious and visceral music of their generation during their utmost creative period, and have maintained a work ethic that has allowed them to build on such a legacy. They are so good at what they do that they, like so many omnipresent musical acts, are maybe even easy to take for granted. They've for so long been a definitive part of the rock zeitgeist, after all. Their third album, Master of Puppets, was reissued late last summer, and it's marked by a tessellation of demos, live performances, and rough cuts. Months later, I received the set as a Christmas present. Since, I've found myself thinking a lot about early Metallica and especially Master of Puppets, a phenomenon upped by the fact that it's one of the handful of CDs most often rotated in my car, a reality brought on by my apathetically never changing out the LPs kept in my console. Sometimes while listening, I try to get in the headspace of a person who was able to spin it in 1986, a year during which Metallica still had not yet broken big globally. Somehow, it seems like a faraway fantasy. For the sake of this episode, let's travel back to March 1986, around the time Master of Puppets was first released and wasn't yet considered the sort of album you'd reissue to earn a few commendatory retrospective pieces and a few extra bucks. Then, Metallica was still a young band in every sense of the term. They'd formed just 5 years earlier, for starters, and they were all barely into their 20s. Yet because their sound was so singular, and because they were so defining in the underground and increasingly popular thrash metal scene, their then small group of fans, and attentive critics alike, were prone to revering the band in the same way you might a veteran group. They were, despite being so young, pioneers, indicative of a particular and burgeoning era in rock music. They were still in the midst of a transitionary period, and were still often slapped with the quote-unquote up-and-coming sticker. Just 3 years into their run, Metallica had released two albums, 1983's Kill 'Em All and 1984's Ride the Lightning, which were both released by the independent label Megaforce Records. While both were well-received by metal devotees and got some good reviews, neither made a major commercial impact in the United States. Things changed shortly after the release of Ride the Lightning when Michael Alago, an Elektra Records representative who'd been a fan of the band for a number of years, signed the band to an 8-album record deal. Around the same time, Metallica parted ways with their loyal, but otherwise inexperienced, manager John Zazula, who also founded Megaforce Records, and hired the renowned management company Q Prime in his place. The band liked working with Zazula, who also had a professional partnership with his wife, Marcia. But Metallica knew that global success would be difficult to achieve while being managed by them, given their limited resources. Said Zazula years later, quote, "It shattered me to lose them for years. Because I thought we would have proved to everybody that we could have taken it all the way. It would have happened with us as well. It was on fire when we gave up the band. Absolutely blazing. It was in the middle of everything going on." Elektra, who Metallica soon signed with, made sure that their transition from Megaforce would be smooth. The former label allowed the latter to continue with Ride the Lightning's release until it sold 75,000 copies. This still doesn't sit well with the Zazulas. They felt as though Elektra had essentially stolen the band that had helped develop for so many years. They reaped the benefits, though. Elektra's deal with Megaforce enabled the smaller of the two labels to continue making money, which would permit Megaforce to put attention on acts like Raven and Anthrax. Even with the hard feelings that came with the outing of the Zazulas, Metallica's decision to sign with Elektra proved a smart one. The autumn of 1984 marked a major turning point. In November, Elektra would re-release Ride the Lightning, which had then already sold more than twice as many copies as Kill 'Em All. Sales skyrocketed internationally, and thanks to savvy marketing of the LP's singles by Metallica's European label, Music for Nations, physical editions of tracks like Creeping Death became popular. To further promote Ride the Lightning, Q Prime managers Cliff Bernstein and Peter Mensch organized the 25-date Bang That Head That Doesn't Bang European tour, which would begin on November 6, 1984, and be supported by Tank, a British heavy metal band. Then, for the first 3 months of 1985, Metallica would embark upon a series of shows in the United States, supported by Wasp and Armored Saint. Metallica hadn't toured in North America for a little over a year. When that tour came to a close, sonically similar bands like Grim Reaper and Slayer started becoming more popular, but they had not reached the heights of Metallica, who had added 100,000 sales to the 75,000 copies Megaforce had already achieved with Ride the Lightning. Cliff Burton, Metallica's bassist, was still living with his parents, while frontman James Hetfield, drummer Lars Ulrich, and guitarist Kirk Hammett were living in the shabby Californian quote-unquote Metalla mansion. Nonetheless, it was evident that they were ascending more quickly than ever, though that did come with much alcohol abuse and incessant partying. Armored Satan bassist and tourmate Joey Vera remembers feeling as though he was watching the band quote-unquote arrive around this period. Quote, "It was a fire that was beginning to burn. That's where I first saw it on a daily basis, in every small town. It's one thing to see something in a magazine or one every show in a big city, but when we were on tour together, we played every shithole across the US. And that's where you got to see, like, wow, this is having the same effect in front of 200 people or in front of 600 people." Unquote. In early summer 1985, Metallica was back in San Francisco. They were done touring, but weren't looking to take a break. They wanted to get in the studio and record their next album, the already titled Master of Puppets. This project came with a lot of pressure, though. It would be the first made with the backing of a major label, and the first where there would be no older tracks to repurpose. And since Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA was the most popular LP in the country at the time, and because Live Aid was on the horizon, there were worries that, even amid rising popularity, the mainstream might not be totally ready for what Metallica had to offer. Was this really to be Metallica's unabashed breakthrough, or would it derail the hype train? Ulrich and Hetfield took it upon themselves to get to working on the blueprints of the album. They took to the garage of the Metalla Mansion, which was located in El Cerrito, and started crafting ideas that eventually turned into demos. Once a good number of their sketches were pretty strong, they invited in Burton and Hammett, both to start jamming and to offer any outlines they might have. On the whole, though, Hetfield and Ulrich are the only members of the band who would be credited on every single one of Master of Puppets' songs. Hammett would get credit on three others and Burton on one additional. Only the title track and the closer, Damage Incorporated, are said in the liner notes to have been crafted by all four constituents. Here's a sample of the demo of the song, which was recorded in late August 1985. Hammond insists, though, that, quote, 99% of it was conceived by the four of us, unquote. There doesn't seem to necessarily be any hard feelings, however. Retrospectively, Hammond considers the finished version of Master of Puppets to be the definitive musical statement from this specific lineup. Every one of the songs that would be featured on the LP was written and pretty much perfected in the garage, save for the 8-minute Orion instrumental and The Thing That Should Not Be. Dave Mustaine, the Megadeth founder who was famously part of Metallica's lineup during its formative years, continues to claim that he should have received a co-credit on Master of Puppets' 6th track, Leper Messiah. Hammond has laughed this allegation off. He remembers being in the room when Ulrich came up with the song's central motif. If anything, Mustaine might have been influential on a 10-second chord progression, but to provide acknowledgement in the liner notes would have been pushing it. Hammond continues to feel like Burton, who, as previously mentioned, is only co-credited on 3 of the album's songs, isn't as praised as he should have been. On Orion, Burton wrote the entire quote-unquote middle part, with the bass lines and 2- and 3-part harmonies arranged by him single-handedly. And the bass-centric intro to Damage Incorporated had evolved from a solo Burton had improvised during the Ride the Lightning era, and had purportedly been based off a Johann Sebastian Bach piece. I'm going to first play part of the Bach song, which is called Come Sweet Death, and then Damage Incorporated's is opening. The resemblance is obvious. There were other esoteric references. The line, "Honesty is my only excuse," which is featured on Damage Incorporated, is an homage to the Thin Lizzy song, "Honesty is no excuse." The guitar passage at the end of Disposable Heroes is supposed to sound like militaristic bagpipes. And Battery's acoustic opening is a tribute to Ennio Morricone, the tireless composer known for his work in the spaghetti western genre. Here is Ecstasy of Gold by Morricone, followed by the Battery intro. After getting most of the tracklist sorted out, Metallica had to go about finding a fitting recording studio. While Fleming Rasmussen, who had co-produced Ride the Lightning, would be working with them again, the band's members, save for Ulrich, didn't want to produce in the producers preferred Copenhagen-based Sweet Silence Studios, where their previous foray had been recorded. This wasn't because the studio itself was poor, it was because Denmark, at the time, was beset with wintry weather conditions, and it was preferable to stick around in sunnier California. Begrudgingly, Rasmussen flew from Denmark to Los Angeles. Upon arrival, he and Ulrich went studio hunting for a period of 2 weeks in July. They were shuffled around in an expensive, Elektra-owned town car. The search, though, proved itself pointless. Studio acoustics, though perhaps satisfactory for the guitar and vocal work, was simply not up to the standards of Ulrich. While recording Ride the Lightning in Denmark, Ulrich's drums were set up in a large storage room in the back of Sweet Silence Studios that allowed the percussion to really boom. This kind of setup just didn't exist in California. Feeling as though the sound of Master of Puppets would suffer if they too drastically altered the system implemented on Ride the Lightning, Ulrich returned to his bandmates and worked to convince them to, once again, make an album in Denmark. As Hammett later recalled, though, it was not Ulrich's drum-related pleas that motivated the decision to return to Sweet Silence. It had more to do with the dollar rate. It was much more affordable, on an hourly scale, to record there than it would be in America. The financial appeal wasn't totally an effect of rigid frugality. It was in part due to an awareness that the low cost would allow the group to feel more comfortable about taking their time in the studio. Plus, Metallica had built a rapport with much of the Denmark studio's personnel, and returning would feel, for all intents and purposes, like coming home. Sessions wouldn't begin until September, though, which led Q Prime to schedule a handful of shows. From midsummer until production, Metallica would play the UK-based Monsters of Rock show at Castle Donington, Oakland's The Day on the Green Festival, and Ryan's Metal Hammer Festival. Each show has come to be legendary, some more than others. The latter appearance is particularly notable for being the first time the act played the In the Making LP's fifth track, Disposable Heroes, live. From the album Master of Puppets, to be out around Christmas time. At the Donington show, at which Metallica played in front of more than 70,000 people and was squeezed between Rat and Bon Jovi, acts the band were known to despise, Hetfield said to the crowd,
"Here to see spandex and fucking eye makeup and all that shit, and the words rock and roll baby in every fucking song. This ain't the fucking band. We came here to bash some fucking heads for 50 minutes. Are you fucking with us?"
This prompted scores of audience members to chuck their drinks at the quartet. Still, this is one of the band's most famous live moments. At the Day on the Green Festival, which happened about 2 weeks later, Metallica played in front of one of their biggest crowds yet, comprising about 90,000 people, and saw what has come to be a climax in their infamous habit of wrecking dressing rooms. Burton, whom Hammett has said was the most mature out of everyone in the band, deplored the ritual, and was generally the one who would reprimand his peers after a particularly bad room-demolishing session. Less than 24 hours after Day on the Green, Hetfield, Hammett, and Ulrich, all of whom were very hungover, left for Copenhagen. Burton would join them later, though he never gave them a reason why. He didn't answer any of their pages or phone calls at the airport. It had been speculated that the latter knew that the first days of quote-unquote production would involve his bandmates setting up, and that it wouldn't be necessary to join them right away. Production officially began on September 3, 1985, though Burton wouldn't be around for about 2 weeks after that. The band's confidence was at an all-time high, partly because of their increasing commercial success, partly because Hammett had been studying with Joe Satriani, with whom he'd worked in the past, and Ulrich had even booked a smattering of drum lessons in his spare time. Even better, the money doled out by Elektra allowed Metallica to stay in the very Tony Scandinavia Hotel, where Hammond and Burton and Ulrich and Hetfield, respectively, would share swanky junior suites. Burton got comfortable immediately after arriving, and would, basically, turn his and Hammond's room into a studio away from the studio. After the band would go on outings to take a breather from studio time, Burton, to Hammond's initial dismay, would frequently come back to the room, plug in his guitar, and urge his bandmate to play with him. Through this, Hammett was able to perfect many of the solos he had in pocket, and Burton, though predominantly a bass player, came to learn the album's guitar parts too. Tangentially, the latter rarely used headphones in the studio. The band was a lot looser in Copenhagen this time around. Though they were productive in the studio and devoted ample time to getting even the most minute of details down, they were able to bond more than they ever had, now that they were, essentially, away from the rest of the world. Hammett has said that when Metallica wasn't playing together, they were playing poker. Quote, "We'd go out and play poker for 8 hours straight after being up for 24 hours. We'd find a seafood restaurant that was open, eat raw oysters, and drink beer." The group had a compulsion to scream playfully at natives while they were inebriated too. Hammett has said that some of his best Metallica-related memories came from this period. He was especially happy to see Hetfield and Ulrich, whose relationship always wasn't the best, hanging out more. Once the group walked through Sweet Silence's doors, though, they were laser-focused. They made sure to abstain from the bottle around recording time. Rasmussen remembers that they would usually begin sessions at 8 p.m., work all night, go back to the hotel to reap the benefits of the complimentary breakfast buffet, and then go to bed. From the beginning, Metallica had decided that they weren't necessarily going to be picking up where they left off with Ride the Lightning. They were going to try to enhance their sound in every way possible, starting with the audio quality. Much of this would be fortuitously accomplished simply by tinkering with an unfamiliar set of knob-heavy boogie amps during the production's first few days. Reverb was scarcely used. But the band's members, in general, were much more self-assured than they were while making Ride the Lightning. Said Rasmussen, quote, "Music-wise, they were a million times better, because they'd been on the road for a year and a half. James was brilliant at this time. It was unbelievable. Some of the rhythm guitars, he'd more or less do them in the first take. Then we'd start doubling up, and that would more or less be on the first take too." When in the process of laying down matching rhythm tracks, Hetfield would begin a habit of adding a third layer on top to further inflate the album's aural richness. Because of this, he was nicknamed the Thickener. Burton and Hammett were more assertive in the production input this time around. Burton is most often credited with providing the album's upped, quasi-neoclassical foundation. In reference to the latter's tendency to reference the sonics of classical music, Hetfield said in a 2017 interview, quote, "Cliff loved chaos that way, musically, where things weren't supposed to be where they are normally," unquote. Hammett still finds the album-making process during this period to be fairly unprecedented. Quote, "It was like we'd got it right this time. The cohesiveness from song to song, track to track, almost made perfect sense to us. It was almost as if it were self-creating. Ideas were flowing in and out of nowhere," unquote. The album was lyrically heavier too, though Hetfield would abstain from writing personally inspired lines until around the time the band started production on 1991's self-titled LP. Master of Puppets would thematically circle around addiction, as evidenced by the title track, religious hypocrisy, the stigmatization of mental illness, and, per usual, the atrocities of war. Hetfield aimed to place the listener in less than ideal imagined scenarios. Here he is talking about his approach at the time during a 2017 Beats 1 interview.
You know, you're done writing about, you know, headbanging, kill them all, and, you know, or at least me trying to expand, you know, it's not like Master of Puppets. You know, now, lyrically, it applies to so many things in life, you know, being manipulated by many, many things if you want to let yourself go there. But it wasn't just drugs. It was, you know, and I think that's kind of a sign of a good song.
For most of the album's tracks, Hetfield takes on the personae of various warped narrators. Most unusually, he takes on the perspective of drugs, apparently, on the song Master of Puppets, though sometimes shifts perspectives and embodies the addict. The quote-unquote master, essentially, is a conglomeration of narcotics and other addictives. The quote-unquote puppets are those who have become dependent on them. Mick Wall, a music journalist who wrote the 2010 Metallica biography Enter Night, considers Master of Puppets, in several ways, to be something of an enhanced version of Ride the Lightning. Even the sequencing is almost matching to a T. The latter LP's first track, Fight Fire with Fire, begins with an acoustic instrumental, just like Master of Puppets' opener, Battery. The 8-plus minute instrumental The Call of Klutu closes Ride the Lightning. The 8-plus instrumental Orion is second to last on Master of Puppets. These are just some of the similarities. Wall suggests that the template following was complementary rather than detrimental. An idea of improvement was fortified. Once recording was completed, Rasmussen and the band were unable to mix the album in a way that pleased everyone involved. In response to this, they, after leaving Sweet Silence at the end of December, gave the master tapes to the renowned, Los Angeles-positioned Michael Wagner in January 1986, with a note saying, "No reverb." The quartet and their co-producer had faith in Wagner. Though he had done the mixing for acts the band wasn't fond of, like Accept, Dokken, and Motley Crue, there was an understanding that he would be able to add a sort of stomachably shimmering sheen that would benefit the roughness of what had been done in Copenhagen. Later, Wagner would say that while working with music like Metallica's was almost foreign to him, he still found it, quote-unquote, interesting. With Hetfield and Ulrich working alongside him, making sure he didn't add unwanted characteristics or take away any coveted attributes, Wagner mixed Master of Puppets in the Californian Amigo Studios. Said Wagner, quote, "James and Lars attended every single mixing session, and James had very definite needs. Those needs, combined with my personal vision, are what you hear on the album," unquote. Wagner's work would be completed just a few weeks later. Once the finished copy of the LP was sent to Michael Allego of Elektra Records, he was enamored of Metallica's offerings, and immediately scheduled the album for a March release. The band was thrilled, but they refused to put out an introductory single, and more vehemently, would not make an interest-piquing music video either. This wasn't because the band was totally uncommercial. To paraphrase Ulrich, networks like MTV wouldn't show a Metallica video anyway, so why bother making one? More publicity might be derived if word got out that the band refused to make a video. It'd only be a few years until the band would go against their early claims and cater to the music video norm, though. The title Master of Puppets, in lieu of technically being about drugs, is contingent with the unwillingness to completely pander to the suggestions made by the corporate side of things. Metallica, despite being grateful for so much of what Elektra was providing them, would not so easily become puppets controlled by a collective, money-minded master. Shortly before the album was released, the band split up. Ulrich wandered around Europe, talking to anyone he could about the LP, while Hetfield headed to the Bay Area, where he would catch up with old friends. During this time, Hetfield, with the help of Fred Cotton, the drummer of Piranha, even formed a supergroup called Spastic Children, which mostly did punk covers on the club circuit. Hammett, Burton, and later Metallica bassist Jason Newsted would join afterward. It was, essentially, a fun side project that would allow everyone involved to let loose. It was, according to Cotton, about being shitty, not making great music, per se. When Master of Puppets was released on March 3rd, 1986, it immediately became a commercial success, though the numbers, of course, were not as behemoth as they'd come to be in the following years. But 300,000 copies in 3 weeks is still pretty staggering. The album debuted at number 128 on the Billboard 200 chart on March 29th. It would peak at number 29, it would stay on the charts for an impressive 72 weeks. Master of Puppets is also notable for earning a gold certification, which was an accreditation that had thus far eluded the act. Critical reviews were almost concordantly positive. In recent years, though, most writings up discuss this album both as a masterpiece and a high watermark for metal. Other comparable acts, like Anthrax, Slayer, and Megadeth, who, with Metallica, are revered as the big four of thrash metal, were also breaking big around this time. To promote the album, the band chose, rather old-fashionedly, to extensively tour rather than use singles and music videos as cushions. To expand Metallica's outreach, Q Prime attached them to open on Ozzy Osbourne's Ultimate Sin Tour, which had started in February. Enthusiastically, they joined the erstwhile Black Sabbath frontman in March. Having idolized Osbourne growing up, it was huge. It would also immensely help boost Metallica's album sales. Touring for Master of Puppets, which either consisted of shows with Osbourne or a number of headlining performances, was tainted by a notable coterie of difficulties. Drinking was a major problem and an open secret. Sometimes the band would wear t-shirts that read Alcoholica / Drink 'em All to poke fun at themselves. Before a show in Adamsville on June 26th, Hetfield got in a skateboarding accident and broke his wrist. That performance was canceled and Hetfield had to go the rest of the tour without his guitar. John Marshall, Hammett's roadie who doubled as the guitarist for the Seattle metal band Metal Church, filled in. But nothing would compare to the tragedy that would impact the band on the night of September 26th. Rather than stay in a hotel in Stockholm where they just played, the band thought it best to immediately drive from the city to Copenhagen, where they'd be playing their next show. Sleeping on a bus didn't seem all too big a deal. The vehicle, an English coach, was uncomfortable and had been transmogrified into a sleeper. Its back seats had been removed, and 8 bunks, made from plywood, had been put in their place. Scanty mattresses were put on top. Because the sleeping arrangements were so uncomfortable, Hammett and Burton would cut cards to decide who would be the one getting the more inviting windowside bunk for the night. On the 26th, Burton was the one who got the berth. Few are able to recall exactly how the night unfolded. Even the driver's identity remains unknown. But what is proven is that in the early hours of the 27th, while the bus was traveling south between E4's 82 and 83 junctions, the vehicle started skidding. The driver says it was because of black ice. Hetfield maintains that the chauffeur was intoxicated. Police found that the tire marks were consistent with cases in the past in which the driver had fallen asleep at the wheel. Suddenly, the bus overturned. Everyone was jolted awake. Hetfield was startled when the nearby coffee machine started emptying its piping contents onto his face. Ulrich was thrust out of bed, and he broke his toe in the process. Hammett jerked up after hearing screaming. Marshall felt a sharp pain in his back. Guitar roadie Aidan Mullen, tour manager Bobby Schneider, and drum tech Fleming Larson would be trapped for an extended period of time. It took 3 hours to rescue Larson. Marshall was the first person to get out of the bus. First, he saw the driver, who was hysterical. Then, he saw Burton. When the vehicle flipped over, Burton had been thrown through the window which sat by his bed. When the bus overturned, it landed on top of him. There was no use in trying to free him. Burton was killed instantly. He was only 24 years old. No charges were ever brought against the driver, who was declared not at fault after clarifying that he was neither overly exhausted nor intoxicated under oath. Understandably, Metallica would not play together again until November. Burton's death would have an impact for the rest of their lives. In 2009, Hammett told Mick Wall, quote, "When I first joined the band, there was a huge infusion of new energy, and up until Cliff died, we were so psyched about everything in life in general. But that kind of ended when Cliff left. I still think about him every day. Something he said, something he did, just something." Burton's funeral took place in San Francisco on October 7th. Orion, one of Metallica's most Burton-dominated tracks, was played. Rather than continue taking more time off to mourn, though, Metallica's members immediately began looking for a new bassist, knowing that it would be the right thing to do professionally. This decision was made with the encouragement of Q Prime, who knew that taking a break at such a pivotal moment in the band's trajectory could be inimical. The hasty way of dealing with Burton's death would make for a factor in interpersonal issues that would progress down the road, however. There are also consistent rumors that Metallica had considered booting Ulrich out for a better drummer just before Burton died, but that the plan had to be scrapped upon the latter's tragic demise, adding to some of the tension. With Burton's family's blessing and a holding of the belief Burton would want them to continue what they'd started, Metallica, after auditioning between 40 and 50 people at Hayward, their favorite practice space, hired the 23-year-old Jason Newsted of the metal band Flotsam and Jetsam. Newsted promptly learned the group's entire discography, though having long been a dedicated fan, he knew how to play most of the music anyway. November 8th marked the first time he played with the group live. The act wasn't quick to welcome him, though. For the first few months of touring, they hazed him in a fashion I'd say is a step below fraternity-level razzing. Hetfield would later say, perhaps inadvertently, he and his bandmates took a lot of their anger regarding Burton's death out on Newsted, and that years later, the act would come to regret regrouping so quickly. Nevertheless, they persisted. They would keep performing, put out a commemorative long-form tribute video for Burton entitled Cliff 'Em All, release a fun, off-the-cuff EP called the $5.98 EP, Garage Days Revisited, and start working on Master of Puppets' follow-up, And Justice for All, in January 1988, which is an LP I love. Persisting, though, is this idea that Metallica was never quite as good as they were during the Master of Puppets / Burton era, even though their commercial prowess would be upped enormously, especially with the release of their real breakthrough, 1991's self-titled full-length, often referred to as the Black Album. Subsequent low points, both artistically and personally, are as notorious as Metallica's inarguable achievements. There continues to be much talk about their putative quote-unquote selling out in the mid to late 1990s, Newsted's sudden departure in 2001, their almost breakup in the early 2000s as Raleigh depicted in Some Kind of Monster, their battles against drug and alcohol abuse, their attack against Napster, the file-sharing service, their awful 2011 collaboration with Lou Reed, and more. But like so many great veteran acts, Metallica has come to a place where old obstacles and bouts of controversy and personal difficulties do little to harm their influence or legacy, something that becomes an inevitability both when you help pioneer a genre and when your first decade of existing is so artistically ripened. Master of Puppets is their most celebrated musical statement. It is a totem of thrash metal. I remain awestruck by its virtuosity. Like Burton always seemed to intend, it does indeed remind me of classical music, because of its consummate musicianship and its tracks' almost symphonic ways of unfolding. I recommend checking out the recently remastered box set edition of the album. It is almost an all-in-one capturing of how great a band Metallica was live, in the studio, and how musically masterly they were even in the planning stages. It also, more remarkably, gives further insight into the making of a masterpiece. Somehow, it makes this already robust album even more powerful. Thanks for listening to the 8th episode of The Definitives. This episode was narrated, researched, and edited by me, Blake Peterson. If you'd like to know more about me, I recommend heading over to my website, petersoninterviews.com, which focuses on cinema, or my Twitter, at Blake W. Peterson. If you want to follow along with the show, next week I will be discussing To Bring You My Love, PJ Harvey's moody, glam-tinged masterpiece from 1995.